Social justice, like world hunger and civil rights, seem like just words we've heard too often, just empty phrases. That is, until we meet somebody whose experiences give life to those words. You're going to do just that today on Connection.
Connection.
Today on Connection, you're going to meet Mrs. Fanny Cheney, a woman for whom social justice and civil rights are more than just the forgotten banners of an earlier decade. You're going to meet Mrs. Cheney not because of some we all ought to feel guilty reason, but because in Mrs. Cheney we find that the Christian faith not only calls us to shake the foundations of justice, but also gives us the strength to face it when injustice and tragedy enter our lives. And the grace that has sustained Mrs. Cheney is the same grace that drives Les White of Wilmington, Massachusetts, to become involved in a drug rehabilitation program. In many ways, each of us are called, by different sounding voices, to meet God and to continue the work of salvation begun so many years ago. The struggle may seem endless, but we have the promise that one day, God's justice will rule over all. We'll return in a moment with Mrs. Cheney. You're listening to Connection.
If you believe within your heart, you'll know that no one can change the path that you must go. Believe what you feel and know you're right, because the time will come around when you'll say it's yours. Believe that you can go home. Believe you can float on air. Then click your heels three times.
You're about to hear from Mrs. Fanny Cheney and the personal tragedies in her life. One son was killed in the civil rights struggle.
Well, he left the house that Sunday, going to the office
on Fifth Street in Meridian, him and Mickey Swan and Andrew Goodman, and he never come back.
Another son is in jail for a crime he says he didn't commit.
He said, "Mom, I'm in jail." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm in jail." I said, "For what? For what?" He said, "Well, Mama, you know, I didn't do what they got me accused of." I said, "What? What they got you accused of? Who got you accused?" He said, "They got me accused of killing, a murder."
Connection talked to Mrs. Fanny Cheney and found a story of amazing courage and faith. At the height of the civil rights struggle in 1964, Mrs. Cheney lived in Meridian, Mississippi. Her eldest son, James, was active in the often violent struggle for civil rights. In August of that year, Mrs. Cheney received a call informing her that James was missing. 45 days later, his mutilated body was found along with the bodies of two other civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner. Mrs. Cheney resolved to carry on the work of her dead son.
Hey, well, you know, they had certain places that blacks couldn't go in, certain places just for the whites. And so a bunch of us just went around, just broke it down, going in on the whites, sitting in the white restaurants around. We wouldn't be served a lot of times. Sometimes, like at the 5 and 10 cent stores in Meridian, you go there and sit at the white county, that if they serve you, they would fix the food so, put so much salt or pepper or something on that you couldn't eat it. But you pay for it right on. And they just, you know, just in a lot of restaurants, we would go in there and ask for stuff. They said, "We ain't got it. We don't sell that." Then some white could come right in and they'll fix it for them.
For her actions, Fanny Cheney began to receive threatening phone calls. Irate people fired gunshots through her house, and she lost all chance of finding work.
I called back to the job and told them that I was ready to come back to work, and they told me that I had more children and something else might happen, and I would have to be off again. So they needed somebody that they could depend on. And so I couldn't get a job there anymore. So I couldn't work at that job no more. And I would go to the employment office, and I kept going. They would put them off. So I just kept going. So finally, a lady told me one day that I had scandalized the Mississippi whites. And so, who would I thought would want me on their job after I had done scandalized the Mississippi whites? So I needed not to never look to work there anymore.
Unable to support her family, she gathered her possessions and, with her remaining children, moved to New York City. At the time of the move, her only surviving son, Ben, was 11. And it was in New York, 6 years later, that she received another phone call.
He called. I didn't get no call. He had tried to call me before that Saturday. Anyway, late that Saturday, and I was there between 3 and 4 o'clock, the phone rang. And I answered the phone. And he said, "Hey, Mama." I said, "Hey." He said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm all right. How you doing? Where you at?" He said, "I'm in South Carolina." I said, "South Carolina?" I said, "What you doing there?" He said, "Sit down." I said, "What you mean?" He said, "I got something to tell you." I said, "What's wrong, Junior?" I said, "Well, what's wrong? Where you at?" He said, "Mama, I'm in jail." I said, "What?" He said, "I'm in jail." I said, "For what? For what?" He said, "Well, Mama, you know, I didn't do what they got me accused of." I said, "What? What they got you accused of? Who got you accused?" He said, "They got me accused of killing, a murder." He said, "The guy you know I left New York with?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "He did some killing down here. And he got killed. And so me and Martin is in jail." I said, "Where by in South Carolina?" He said, "It's a little place you call Ridgeland." And then I said, "Well, don't say nothing and don't talk until I get there. I'm going to try to get there as soon as I can and bring and get a lawyer."
Ben was originally denied his request to call his mother. Only after interrogation was he allowed to contact her. Mrs. Cheney made arrangements for a lawyer who arrived after Ben had undergone 3 days of questioning. A psychiatrist testified at Ben's trial that at the time of his arrest, he was suffering from schizophrenia, and because of his fear of Southern law enforcement officers, could not possibly have made voluntary statements. According to that psychiatrist, This fear was reinforced by the officers who reminded Ben of his dead brother's fate. Ben was convicted of felony murder, meaning that he was present at the time of a murder, and was given 2 life sentences in prison. Throughout this ordeal, Mrs. Cheney has turned to her church and to her God.
I prayed and I prayed night and day. I asked God, I said, what's wrong? How come this gotta be me? How come my children can't grow up like nobody? And it just looked like something come to me and said, well, we all has got to be tested. So it's a test for everybody. Everybody's got to roll the pool. And if you can pass the test, you can pass. You made it. So I guess this is a test that I have got to pass. But God has given me strength, and he's helping me. He's given me strength, and he's helping me. I mean, look like one time, though, I felt like that I didn't know why and what, how come it had to be me and my children or what. I didn't have nothing, never have had nothing. And why that we had to suffer, I thought, but as hard as it was for me trying to work and send them to school and to raise them, that was hard enough, looked like. And it looked like that was tough enough, but I guess God knows what's best. And that's the way I feel about it.
The Grace United Methodist Church in New York City has started a Ben Cheney Defense Fund to help pay for the complicated legal battle still going on over the case. At the end of our interview with Mrs. Cheney, she had one more thing to say.
Is all I'm asking is them just to bring him close to home. If they're going to put all this time on him and just going to make him do it because he's just a black boy, just bring him close to home where I can visit him. And I'll feel satisfied. God will let me be satisfied with that.
Why is it when I hear the words of Mrs. Cheney that I feel that I've heard those words before? Is it sympathy I feel? Anger? Is this hurting in my heart a reminder from God that all is not right in creation? Is the weeping for each child we lose God's way of telling us that we're all brothers and sisters in Christ? God's love is for us all, without reservation, without limitation. But occasionally you might hear a little voice in the whirlwind that tugs at your heart. At least I do. You're listening to Connection. This week we start a new series of commentaries on television by Ben Logan, one of the creators of television awareness training. I think you'll find them interesting and helpful.
One of the rituals of airplane travel is saying to the person next to you, "What do you do?" When I'm asked that, I often say, "I teach people how to watch television." Then there's a pause while the person looks at me and thinks I'm crazy. Because just about everyone assumes we already know how to watch TV. I don't think that's a safe assumption. Millions of younger Americans were born into the television age. For them, looking closely at TV is like asking a goldfish to look at water. It's simply there, surrounding them. For the rest of us, television just sort of happened. In either case, we never prepared for it, never decided, consciously at least, what role it would play in our lives. Even now, when research makes it clear that TV has a massive influence on our ideas and behavior, on how we use our time and spend our money, we still seem to go on letting TV use us rather than us learning how to use TV. When I say I teach people how to watch television, I'm talking about television awareness training, a program the United Methodist Church helped to create in partnership with 2 other denominations. TAT, as the program is called, conducts workshops where films, program excerpts, and a workbook help people learn more about such problems as violence and stereotyping, how TV affects children, and how human sexuality is presented on the screen. People come out of TAT workshops knowing more about the TV system, about their own rights, and knowing, too, how to get better command of how they use television. For information about television awareness training in your area, write to Connection. This is Ben Logan.
We look forward to hearing more from Ben Logan on future programs. If you're interested in finding out more about TAT, Television Awareness Training, write to us at Connection, Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202. I'll repeat the address at the end of the program. This is Connection. Les White is a member of the Wilmington, Massachusetts United Methodist Church. In 1977, he was given the Southern New England Conference Award for Excellence in Social Justice Action. He received the award for his involvement in several projects which help persons. Les talked with Connection about SHARE Incorporated, one of the projects he helped to start. SHARE is a nonprofit drug rehabilitation and prevention program serving the communities of Greater Lowell, Massachusetts. After spending more than a year studying the problem and possible solutions, Les and others in the area formed a regional organization. SHARE's first project was a controversial methadone clinic. It was just the first step. Les describes their next effort to help heavy drug users. At the same time, he offers some insights into the problems these people face.
We started a therapeutic community in Nabis' house in Lowell, recognizing that many addicts actually get through their late teens, early 20s with arrested emotional development. They miss the years, the teen years, in which most of us had to cope with problems, and they jumped over that problem-solving experience. Though suddenly they're late teens, early 20s, and they're not able to cope with society other than to continue to use drugs. The therapeutic community provided that phase of problem-solving. And what it actually did was take the people back, regardless of their age, to their early teens, and require them to go through an accelerated problem-solving phase of their lives.
Les White has no illusions about the effectiveness of drug rehabilitation. The rate of cure is very low. However, Cher has made a commitment to help people in need. Even one cure is worth the effort. But the real hope in the area of drug abuse is prevention, and for Les, prevention means education.
If anything at all is going to be done about the drug problem, there has to be a great deal of education. You can treat people who are already hung up on drugs, but that's almost too late. You dry out a drug addict, cure him of his physical addiction, but you don't do anything to cure the reason that he took drugs in the first place. So we could see from the very beginning that education was going to be the answer, if there was going to be an answer. Consequently, one of the arms that we built, and actually is our biggest arm today of SHARE, is the educational arm. And that arm gets into not only into education, but also gets into counseling of young people before they get hung up on drugs, before they use drugs as a way of solving a problem. The old scare tactics of educating by telling the young people the horrors of drugs and show them films of drug addicts doesn't work. But when I say education, I mean teaching the young people how to make judgments and how to make decisions, value clarification, and helping the young people to, when they make a decision, make that decision based on some sort of reason, on thought process, rather than on pure emotion or peer pressure.
Peer pressure is something Les understands. Some church members think there should be a greater emphasis on religious values in SHARE's programs, but Les disagrees. He stresses that SHARE is not a church program. It's a community project. And while various churches have supported SHARE, Les feels that the drug program is not a device for evangelism or Christian education. Nevertheless, he does believe that a real part of Christ's work is being done in SHARE's programming. Les is firmly convinced that Christ's work can be done without having to label it.
My Christian input into this organization was the very fact that I was there, that I was, out of my Christian beliefs, involved with concern and working with other people and for other people. I like to think that that has some impact. I keep preaching it now at the church, and probably always will, that we have to get outside ourselves. We've got to not use the church as a place to go on Sunday and to be comforted and to feel good and go away and spend the rest of the week living our lives. People in the church will tell you, I guess, that I'm always pushing for something. So if someone accuses me of that, I'll raise my hand. Yeah. The church should be a place where committed Christians come together for strength and for a community, and then reach out in the community around them. That's what it's all about.
The church at work reaching out to help. Les White says that's what it's all about. The young people whose lives have been touched by SHARE would probably agree.
If we only have love, then tomorrow will dawn, and the days of our years will rise on that morn. If we only have love to embrace without fear,
we will kiss with our eyes. We will sleep without tears. If we only have love, we can melt all the guns and then give the new world to our daughters and sons. If we only have love, then Jerusalem stands. Shadow, there are no foreign lands. If we only have love, we will never bow down. We'll be tall as the pines, neither heroes.
On today's program, we've heard from three different people expressing their faith, their beliefs and concerns in three very different ways. Benjamin Disraeli once said that justice is truth in action. With God's truth in action in your life, however you express it, justice will triumph. Connection is brought to you at this time each week by the United Methodist Church. If you have any questions or comments, please write to us at Connection, Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202. That's Connection, Post Office Box 6, Nashville, Tennessee, 37202. I'm Bill Richards. Connection.